now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. Photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I will be talking about a few topics. The first will be what I'm going to be discussing in my upcoming lecture series known as the Reptilian MyLab Chronicles Lecture and Workshop Series. I'll be speaking for at least 4 hours, probably closer to 4.5. Throw in a couple of 15-minute breaks. So all up, the whole event will be about 5 hours. Very affordable price. Cheap, actually. Cheap as. Dirt cheap compared to some of these fake lightworkers out there, and I'll talk more about that. I will be talking about a variety of issues. Think of it as a full-scale briefing within that allocated time, say 4.5 hours. I will give as much information as I can about reptilians, their modus operandi, what they're trying to achieve with the various forms of programming, physical programming, behavioral psychological programming, sexual programming, astral dreamscape manipulation, astral abductions, etc., etc. I will talk about what they're doing and why they're doing it, what kinds of changes they are striving to affect within the abductee. What kinds of behavioral changes? What kinds of psychological changes? What kinds of spiritual changes even they're trying to affect? And how they can work through people around you also. That's important to know. This really is a matrix, and they will work through anyone who happens to be around you. If they can't get to you and your shields are too strong, they'll muck with you through the people around you or insert people into your life. I will also talk at length about MyLabs, MyLab experiences, the different types of programming, physical, sexual, astral, behavioral, what they're trying to achieve, why, and basically give the people in attendance a comprehensive conceptual framework for what it is they're going through. This is not a lecture for beginners. This is not a lecture for those who still need convincing about the reality of alien abductions, reptilian abductions, military abductions. Certainly not a place for New Age la-di-das, and it's certainly not a place for anyone who presumes to be thought police for anyone else. Oh, you're scaring these people, Bartley. You're scaring these people. These morons presume to decide what is permissible for others to hear and what is not permissible. And they like to use the whole fear thing. Oh, you're just saying scary things. No. I'm going to be giving a full-scale briefing, just as if you're being briefed by an intelligence officer about actual or potential threats. If we were back in the day and the Mongols were invading and you had the misfortune of having the Battle of Mongols, if you were smart and you weren't arrogant like a lot of the Europeans were when they battled the Mongols, you would pay attention, find out their tactics, the Mongols' tactics, how they operate, how they use mobility as a weapon. That's what you would do if you were smart about it. Learn everything you can about an enemy or a potential enemy. You want to learn everything about them, what weapons they use, their tactics, weapon systems, etc., etc., etc. Back in the day when someone said, oh, the Mongols are coming, nobody said, oh, you're being fear-based. Stop trying to scare me. I don't want that negative energy in my energy field. It didn't happen that way. People said, oh, the Mongols are coming? I'm getting the F out. They were smart, right? Especially if they happened to be part of a civilization or a culture that had wronged the Mongols in some way. Then they would have been in serious trouble. I will be talking at length about what my labs go through, the different types of ops, the different types of training. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time. I've never really had the opportunity. Well, not since Memphis, many, many moons ago. Probably still to this day. And this goes back, late 90s, early 2000s. I gave a workshop in Memphis, Tennessee. About 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And I was seated there at a table. I had my notes and papers laid out. And had a nice cozy atmosphere, about, 20 or 30 people there that had seen me give a lecture, and then they wanted to know more, so they paid for the workshop, and I gave them an earful. And it was people that wanted to hear the information, people that were in need of the information. And I was able to get through a lot of information in about 2.5 hours worth, and I've always wanted to go back and do that. Part of a lecture, say a 90-minute lecture, is, for the most part, it's informational. When you're taught public speaking, you're taught the different types of speeches, informational speech, a persuasive speech, etc., etc. Even my lectures are not meant for beginners. They're not meant for people who need convincing. So they're not persuasive speeches. They're informational speeches. And so this lecture workshop series will be just me going down the list, just checking off all these different aspects of reptilian abductions, the reptilian overlordship, MyLab experiences, the types of MyLab ops, Earth ops, off-world ops, time travel ops, different types of things people have described, people that I've vetted personally, people I know personally. So I'm really looking forward to it. And it's extremely inexpensive. So I've taken basically that excuse away. Because I look around and I see these fake light workers who charge these exorbitant fees for their workshops. And this is what their workshops are like, folks. Okay, we're going to have a group visualization now. And after about 20, 25 minutes with maybe accompanying music of desert nighttime wind sounds or something, then it'll be, okay, we're going to do 20 minutes of oming. Om. Om. And then after that, we're going to do 20 minutes of a group meditation. And after which, Mr. Fake Lightworker Guru sticks his hand out and says, that'll be $400, F you very much. Or $600, or $800. It's amazing how much these people charge. And the people get nothing out of it, except maybe a few extra entities that they didn't have when they first went in there. You see, I don't do group meditations, okay? I'm not going to sit there in a group meditation opening myself up and sharing my energetic auric field with all these other people, with Mr. Hostie on the right and Miss Entity Attachment, Cord Attachment on the left. Ain't going to happen, right? So that's what these things usually consist of, just group visualizations, group meditations, oming, toning, chanting. Oh, that'll be $600, $900, $1,200, F you very much. And, please take the entities with you. That's free, courtesy, gratis, part of the program. Right? No. What I'm going to do, I'm going to give a full-scale military-style briefing. And so anyone who's really had these experiences, reptilian abduction experiences, alien abduction experiences also, not just reptilians, but I'll emphasize the reptilians because that's pretty much my field, and the MyLab aspects. Anyone who's gone through those experiences will recognize and in many cases be intimately familiar. Whether they realize what I'm describing is part of the overall experience. It may not have dawned on them prior to hearing this stuff that, oh, you mean that's part of it? I've had that. I have that. I've had that a lot. Because sometimes what people need is a conceptual framework. Group meditations don't provide that. Toning and oming don't provide that. Sitting in a group meditation with Mr. Hosty on the right in the lotus position doesn't provide that. I'm providing real-time int intelligence, actionable intelligence, as they say. Something that people can make use of. Because these reptilians in particular, they're nothing if not dogmatic. They are complex to the extreme. They do the same things over and over and over, folks, for the most part, because they work. That's the main reason why they do the same things over and over and over. It's that reptilian lizard brain of theirs. They're maladaptive. They're not innovative. They just keep doing the same things over and over because, for the most part, they work. But, like I've said many times, the tide has turned. Energetic shift is occurring. More and more people are waking up to the nature of this level of manipulation. So a lot of their tried and true tactics and methods in the past aren't working so well. So after a while, well, they're not going to entirely go away. They'll still come around for like nuisance value every once in a while. But if they cannot engender the kind of changes they want inside of you, behaviorally, psychologically, emotionally, sexually, indeed spiritually, they'll go look for weaker prey. It's like a wolf pack or a lion pride. They're going to look for the animals in a herd that are infirm, slow, older, the easier prey. And so when these reptilians realize they can't get any mileage out of you, well, we tried this, that didn't work. We tried that, that didn't work. We tried a combination of those two things. That didn't work either. After a while, they're just going to say, oh, no, we'll start working on the next door neighbor, right? Because they're not going to spin their wheels. If they can't get what they want from you, right? If you don't feed them with fear and agitation and anxiety and rage and aggression and everything else, they're just going to move on. They'll still, like I said, they'll still come around every once in a while to keep you under surveillance, and they'll try to catch you when your guard is down. And they'll try to manipulate you when you're at a vulnerable point. And also, they will frequently try to manipulate you and by working through people around you or people they insert into your life. But after a while, take my word for it, I know this is a fact. After a while, they're just, you know, if they can't get to you one way, they'll try another. And then if they try to send people in to make you miserable and get you agitated, and if that doesn't work because you don't want to feed them, because the ones that they're sending towards you or to you to cause trouble, either, you know, face-to-face or in your neighborhood or online, right? If you don't respond in kind, then you're not feeding them and you're not nourishing them at your own expense. So, you know, because there's no shortage of these hosty, rage-filled, hate-filled, reptilian-Draco hybrid hosts. They're everywhere. And so in true hive consciousness fashion, they can just plug into these people and direct them towards you online or some other way. But if you don't feed them, you know, you shield them off of you, you'll be fine. So that's the purpose of my lecture workshop series, is to provide a comprehensive conceptual framework for what people are going through. And I know that, you know, economically, financially, people are going through a hard time out there. But what I'm asking, the very low price I'm asking for admission for what is a 4.5 hour event where I'll be just talking and talking at length. And anyone who's seen my lectures knows that I go into detail. I talk a lot. A lot of people, what you get out of them is a lot of conjecture, a lot of speculation, a lot of stuff really that doesn't really matter. I don't do that because time is limited. I'm only allocated so much time. People can only sit still for so long before their attention wavers and their mind wanders. So I'm going to be giving a full-scale briefing for people who desperately need the information. I don't want New Age la-di-das there. Their entities won't let them go there anyway, except for nuisance value. People get very little mileage out of me because I don't put up with crap at my lectures. I'm the one who does the talking because I'm the one that people have come to see. So I'm not going to sit there and, you know, let some self-indulgent person just sit there and talk and talk and talk. Ain't going to happen. So I'm really excited about this lecture workshop series, the Reptilian MyLab lecture workshop series, Reptilian MyLab Chronicles lecture workshop series, I should say. So to find out more, because it will be a series, I will be going to different places and trying to get the message out to as many people as possible who are having these experiences. So stay tuned. Go to thecosmicswitchboard.com to find out if I will be giving a lecture in your area. The next thing I want to talk about is the talismanic invocational impact of Latin in the medical field. I believe Latin is one of those overt, magically energized languages. Okay, think of Dr. John Dee and Kelly doing the scrying exercises, which resulted in the acquisition of the so-called angelic language of Enochian, apparently through the scrying method. Kelly was seeing this angel, quote-unquote, could have been an ET, who knows, providing symbols and the pronunciation of symbols and words. And in this process, John Dee was the astrologer royal for Queen Elizabeth the First, the astrologer royal, the original 007. That's how he signed his name. So an entire angelic language was obtained by Dr. John Dee, and Dr. John Dee being the astrologer royal for Queen Elizabeth, an adept, he used the Enochian language and the ability to manifest and the ability to affect change, not only in this dimension, but in other dimensions, through this Enochian language. He used it to further not only his own agenda, but of course, his liege's agenda, Queen Elizabeth I. It has been said, I have no reason to doubt this, that when the Spanish Armada was going to invade England in 1588, Dr. John Dee and Queen Elizabeth put out a call to all the warlocks and witches of England and asked them to cast a spell that would create a terrific storm to thoroughly thrash the Spanish Armada. And the Spanish Armada was thrashed by a large storm. The invasion was thwarted. A number of the Spaniards washed up in Ireland, interbred with some of the locals, offspring that were generated in this fashion, became known as the Black Irish. Interesting how these things work. The Irish, of course, were Catholics. That was not the first time that magic had been utilized as a state weapon, and it certainly wasn't the last time magic, with a K at the end, was utilized as a weapon of state. In fact, every time they perform these ceremonies, advance their agenda, they're basically using magic, ceremonial magic, to advance the reptilian overlordship globalist agenda. Now, getting back to Latin, okay, of course we know that Latin was the language of the Romans, the Roman Empire. The Romans, over time, had subjugated and turned into vassals most of the tribes in the Italian peninsula and imposed Latin as a common language. Fast forward, and then Catholicism, the Vatican, Christianity takes over, and then Latin becomes the main language of Catholicism, Christianity. In fact, the so-called Vulgate Bible was in Latin, and I believe from the 16th century on, if not sooner, the Vulgate Bible was basically the main Bible of the Catholic Church. And so you had this bizarre spectacle of these priests, and of course it was a priesthood, right? Patriarchal. You had this bizarre spectacle of these priests preaching to their congregation, to their flocks, in Latin, a language that few of the people even understood. So it was this kind of woo-woo, metaphysical, talismanic thing going on, where the people who spoke Latin, of necessity, and by the way the system worked, automatically had more power over those who did not speak Latin, right? Just think of all the Englishmen, Anglo-Saxons, that had to sit and listen to these monks, these priests, drone on and on and on in Latin, right? And it was a hellfire damnation kind of message, of course. It's all about control. It's all about fear. It's all about, well, you don't do what you're told, you're going to go to hell, right? Okay, what's the relationship to modern medicine? Well, let's look at modern medicine. Let's look at the way that Latin somehow, as if by magic, has found its way into the medical profession. Okay, they've got to call these conditions something, okay? If someone has some kind of issue, a cardiovascular issue, some kind of immune system issue or whatever, they have to call it something. But does it have to be called something in Latin? Does it have to be a Latin word? Okay, let's create a hypothetical scenario, which happens all the time, okay? Picture yourself in an emergency ward, and a doctor is talking to a mother, and the mother is worried about the condition of her a young boy who had experienced a health issue in class, had to be rushed by ambulance to the emergency ward. And the mother was called in. The mother went to the school to find out about her boy. They told her to go to the hospital. She drove to the hospital, went to the emergency ward. And after a while, a doctor comes out to talk to the mother. And the doctor says, "Mrs. Jones, I must tell you what has happened to your son. He suffered from," okay, it's pronounced vasovagal syncope. So, Mrs. Jones, your son had experienced vasovagal syncope. Well, what is that? In lay terms, her son fainted. Her son fainted in class, right? Lack of oxygenated blood getting to the brain. He had a fainting episode. But they've got to mystify everything, because the doctor is part of a modern priesthood, okay? And he's applying this woo-woo kind of mysticism, this kind of assumed superiority, because he speaks the secret language, don't you know? And there are countless such examples where you have a name of a condition, a name of a procedure. It's in Latin. And then the patients have to sit there while this doctor, a male or a female, assumes superiority because they've been to medical school, and they can throw all this magical lingo at her, right? There's a reason, folks, why Latin has worked itself into so much of our modern lives. So many aspects of in law, jurisprudence, medicine, everywhere you look, there's a root word, root language connection to Latin in particular. Sure, there's a lot of Greek mixed in there, right? But Latin seems to be the preferred language, the overt language. Remember, Enochian was a secret kind of hidden language that had to be retrieved back from the so-called angels that were angel that Dr. John Dee was working with. But Latin was given to us by the priesthood, and the priesthood, as we know, are a bunch of pedophiles, a bunch of Satanists, and a bunch of shapeshifters. And so they took a language spoken by the Romans, and then they used that as a basis for their language of authority, language of power, through the Vulgate Bible, through the Latin only, as far as the sermons were concerned, only Latin would be used. This went on for a long time, leaving the true believers completely mystified, right? What the hell are these guys saying? Because it was all patriarchal, all these guys. And now we fast forward to modern times, and now it's male doctors and female doctors who assume as air superiority because they went to medical school and were taught all these terms, and now they're using these Latin words to describe medical conditions and medical procedures to thoroughly mystify, befuddle, intimidate patients, right? I'll give you another example. A carotid endarterectomy. We have to do a carotid endarterectomy to your son, Mrs. Jones. Well, what is that? Well, it's a removal of a blockage in the carotid arteries. Well, why don't they just say that? Why don't they just say, we're going to remove a blockage in the carotid artery? Here's another one. Mrs. Jones, your problematic son, he's also suffering from diurnal enuresis. He's suffering from diurnal enuresis. And the mother goes, what? Is it serious? Is it serious? Well, you just have to wash the bed sheets more often, Mrs. Jones, because diurnal enuresis is bedwetting. But again, because they use Latin in a talismanic, Michael Tesserian talked about this, the talismanic power of invoking names, invoking phrases, invoking certain themes over and over and over. Hollywood does this. The school systems do this by repetition. And also by using Latin, again, they invoke this sort of, there's a sort of assumed authority, presumed authority, presumed omniscience, where, okay, we're doctors, we speak in this secret language, not really secret, but in this highfalutin language based on Latin. Right, we can't tell you in simple English that your son is bedwetting, Mrs. Jones. We've got to like blow smoke at you, tell you that he's suffering from diurnal enuresis and make you freak out in the process, right? Here's another one. Cholecystectomy. Removal of the gallbladder. Now, the gallbladder, folks, is the go-to organ for psychosurgeons. Right, they got this scam worked out. And if you ask the older people in your family and your extended family and your friends, and you know, just discreetly inquire about what kinds of surgeries they've had over the years, you'll hear many of them say, well, they had a gallbladder removed, right? See, what happens is the primary care physicians, known as the general practitioners in other Western countries, they have the scam worked out where, say, someone is suffering from hemorrhoids. Oh, you know, instead of just saying, okay, you've got hemorrhoids, because of the scam, they say, well, it looks like hemorrhoids, but it could be something else. Mrs. Jones, right? I really encourage you. In fact, you must see the specialist, right? The surgeon. You know, and they were encouraged to contact this person right away. You must call up. Call up Monday morning. Call up tomorrow morning, as soon as possible. You must see this specialist slash surgeon. So they call up and they go, well, yes, you know, my primary care physician, Dr. Quack, recommended that I, you know, come in for a visit, right? And, of course, the patient, the would-be patient, Mrs. Jones in our example, she goes in and she's examined by the specialist. And surprise, surprise, there's something wrong with your gallbladder, Mrs. Jones. It's got to come out. The gallbladder is the go-to organ for these psychopath surgeons to make money. I know a number of adults, a number of elderly people who are lacking in gallbladders because they were surgically removed for no real obvious reason other than some made up. I know someone who had their gallbladder removed because of hemorrhoids, right? I'm not a medical person. I can't speak Latin, right? But it's like what does the two have in common? But it's just an excuse to yank an organ out of people. And some of these surgeons, they're just full-on psychopaths. They love cutting into people. And if you listen to Janice Barcello, my interview with her, she talks about how empathy is drummed right out of these residents and doctors in medical school. And I worked at a medical education center before, and I dealt with some of these residents. And man, the egos they had, and they were just lowly residents. They weren't even, you know, real MDs yet. They already had the ego thing going. And so, yeah, gallbladder. So here's this thing, cholecystectomy. Instead of just saying, oh, it's a removal of a gallbladder, you got to come up with this highfalutin name. But see, that works in the talismanic invocational sense. You must have this cholecystectomy, Mrs. Jones, before your condition worsens. Because if you wait too long, I can't do anything to help you. Call up my office. Make an appointment with my secretary as soon as possible. We have to get you in there. And Mrs. Jones, in our example, the long-suffering Mrs. Jones, I might add, goes in dutifully and has her gallbladder removed for no reason whatsoever other than to make money for this psychopath surgeon. Okay? And I've worked in the medical field, folks. I've worked in a number of big hospitals before, big and small hospitals. I've seen what goes on in these different departments. I've seen what goes on. I've seen the symbiotic relationship between big pharma and the the medical field. So keep that point in mind. Latin is being utilized in the medical field because there's a magical power that it exudes. It worked just the same in the Middle Ages. It worked just the same, you know, in the 16th century. Some priest, some highfalutin, high and mighty priest, just talking in Latin, talking in gibberish, and the fearful, frightened, you know, churchgoers just allowing themselves to be terrified. And it's the same dynamic, folks, when this doctor starts using all this Latin on a frightened patient, right? And imposing his or her will upon that patient, mystifying what should be a very straightforward process, right? You need to have your gallbladder taken out. Well, sometimes not. Okay, bad example, right? I mean, they have to Latinize everything in the medical field. So keep that point in mind, folks. It's important to understand that Latin itself, the Latin language, is a language of control. It was utilized by the Romans. That's why, you know, Spain and France are Latin-based languages. Okay? How did Spanish wind up being a Latin-based language? Well, because of the Second Punic War. The Carthaginians had established a base. The Carthaginians were from Carthage, modern-day Libya, Tunisia, that area. It was a large seafaring empire, right? They're transplanted Phoenicians, basically, and they occupied parts of Sicily, and Rome was just starting to become a superpower, and they engaged the First Punic War, Punic being the Latin word for Phoenician, because the Romans being the victors, they the historians call it the Punic Wars to blame the Carthaginians, right? But the Carthaginians were not choir boys, a bad example. They were not saints, kind of bad example too. The Carthaginians practiced human sacrifice. They sacrificed little babies to their god Moloch, right? Baal, another one of their deities. They practiced human sacrifice, child sacrifice, particularly. So the Romans defeated the Carthaginians in the First Punic War. And in the Second Punic War, the son of the defeated general in the First Punic War was Hannibal Barca. Hannibal was the son of general that was defeated by the Romans in the First Punic War. In the Second Punic War, Hannibal decided to use Spain as his stronghold, his base of operations, because the Carthaginians had been in Spain for some time, the Iberian Peninsula. They had subjugated some of the tribes in Spain and the Iberian Peninsula, forced them to work in mines. And so the Barcid family in particular, it's up in the air whether the Carthaginian nation state was really behind this, or if it was just kind of a private corporate enterprise within the Barcid family. The general who was defeated by the Romans in the First Punic War was Hamilcar Barca. His son, Hannibal Barca, was the guy who prosecuted the Second Punic War. And long story short, the Romans, under their general, Scipio Africanus was the honorific title he was later given, Publius Cornelius Scipio, defeated Hannibal in the Second Punic War, and that's how Rome took over Spain. And then they force Spain, rather Roman, the language, Latin, upon the inhabitants. And that's why Spain is a Latin-speaking country. Spanish is derived from Latin, which came from the Romans. Okay. And then fast forward, about 150 or so years later, Julius Caesar wages war on the Gallic tribes in Gaul, modern-day France, Belgium, and basically subjugates large parts of Gaul, modern-day France, modern-day Belgium, and wipes out hundreds of thousands, if not a million, natives. I mean, it was a war of extermination, and so many of these people were taken into slavery. And that's why France is a Latin-based language, because Julius Caesar went there and, imposed his will on the natives, right? So the point of relevance here, folks, is Latin is a language of control. It's a language of power. And the modern priesthood, or at least one aspect of it, is the medical profession, with a constant invocation in a talismanic fashion of these Latin words, diurnal enuresis or enuresis to describe bedwetting. Just tell us, bedwetting, okay? Mrs. Jones, your son suffers from bedwetting, right? Don't try to scare her with these woo-woo sounding Latin words, right?
One last thing about the priesthood, the Latin connection, the medical priesthood, etc. Think back to the Catholic monks with their shaved heads. The top of their head is shaved, and there's a ring of hair below the top of their head. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Bald head with a ring or a fringe of hair further down the head. That's Saturn, folks, okay? That's Saturn worship. It's another manifestation of Saturn worship. When a kid is born in the hospital, what's one of the first things they do? They slap a skull cap on its head. That's Saturn worship. That's tagging the baby, saying, Welcome to the Saturn Matrix Moon System. Always remember that Saturn and the Moon and the Saturn Moon Matrix plays a fundamental role in all this. I'm going to talk now about yet another failed U.S. special operations, this time in Yemen. I don't have time today to talk about the long sordid history of what's gone on in Yemen over the decades, the involvement of Western special forces, Western recruited mercenaries. And now, fast forward to today, and we have this SEAL team raid, and if some of the fake news reports are correct, it was done in conjunction with United Arab Emirates special forces, which automatically, right off the bat, that violates unity of command, one of the basics taught in military schools, or at least they used to. One Navy SEAL was known to have been killed. Other reports suggest that there were more U.S. casualties. And also, let us not forget the at least 30 civilian casualties that were killed in this abortive raid, supposedly to acquire computers, computer files, laptops, etc., etc. That's the spin that's been put out. And it sounds like it was another ambush, almost didn't know any better, another Mogadishu-style disaster. The Pentagon and the Spinmeisters are putting out all this fluff about, oh, well, there were female combatants there, females that were taking up firing positions and shooting at the SEALs, and that doesn't hold any water. U.S. Army Ranger School recently passed in their selection process the first two female U.S. Army Rangers. There have been females flying as U.S. Air Force fighter bomber pilots, as well as U.S. Naval aviators. And both U.S. Naval aviator females and U.S. Air Force females have dropped ordnance on people and property. So, yeah, they should not blow smoke about, oh, females were engaging, and therefore somehow it's justifiable to wipe out all those civilians. Because it turned out it became another massive hammer blow instead of a surgical strike. It turned into an ambush, and then they called in, as is usually the case when American forces get ambushed and pinned down, they called in air support, Harrier jump jets from a nearby U.S. Gator carrier, and they called in Apache helicopter gunships. And they unleashed a lot of ordnance. The Harriers dropped bombs. And I'm sure there was far more than just 30 civilians killed. And, oh, surprise, surprise, another Osprey, the MV-22 Ospreys. These are the tilt rotor planes created by Boeing. When the propellers are in their forward position, the aircraft flies like a plane, and then in mid-flight, they can tilt the propellers upward, and then it becomes a rotary aircraft, i.e. a helicopter. These things are so dangerous. These things crash so often. It was designed to transport U.S. military, rather U.S. Marines. These things have crashed so many times with U.S. Marines on board. The nickname for the Osprey is the Marine Killer. And they use this in the operation. Okay, so this is just the latest example of how U.S. Special Operations Forces are misused and just sent in to be slaughtered and sent in to be humiliated in the eyes of the world. And never mind all the civilians that were killed. The whole purpose, supposedly, was to fight Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Oh, roll the eyes again. Al-Qaeda, is it? And we know that Al-Qaeda has been supplied by the West, by the U.S., by the Saudis, by all the so-called good guys, right? So these troops are going in there to try to obtain vital intelligence, we're told, from an Al-Qaeda stronghold, from an Al-Qaeda that has been supplied by the West. We've seen this over and over in Iraq, right? Over and over and over, they bust the U.S. Air Force dropping air supplies to the ISIS in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Iraqi military, which was already hammered into pieces by the U.S. in two wars, then they're supposed to be left to fend for themselves and deal with this ISIS threat. That didn't work out. ISIS moved in and took ownership of thousands of American Humvees. Thank you very much. So in order to deal with this new threat of ISIS, the U.S.-supplied ISIS, driving around in U.S.-supplied Humvees left over by the U.S. who left, right, and at least most of the conventional army and military left the Iraqi army to their own devices, well, the ISIS moved in, took ownership of the Humvees, thousands of them. In order to combat that menace, the U.S. went and sent in supplies of anti-tank missiles. But it's questionable who really got that in Iraq, whether the missiles actually went to ISIS again or they actually went to the Iraqi army. The whole thing is a big cluster of muck. But it's meant to be that way. It's designed to be that way. That's what this is all about. It's perpetual war. It's perpetual war to destabilize the world, and whatever's left over will be ripe for the plucking. So now back to Yemen. Now we're supposed to believe that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a big threat. And so they send in these SEAL teams, or a SEAL team, a rather large team, and they had Emirate Commandos, I believe United Arab Emirate Commandos with them, completely violating the concept of unity of command, and then they wind up getting ambushed, and then they have to call in the air support, and they just level the place. They killed an 8-year-old American citizen, a little girl, and we're going to see more of this, because you know, Trump is pretty much a cowboy. They thought Ronald Reagan was a cowboy. I think, you know, Trump may be more of a cowboy. Apparently, Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, an Israeli citizen and a former member of the Israeli Defense Force, played a key role in authorizing this mission. Right? So, wow, that's great job being a commander-in-chief, Donald, letting your son-in-law, a dual citizen, give the go-ahead for this op. And again, this happens over and over and over again. I'm against war. I'm against war because it's used for all the wrong purposes. It's one thing to use violence to defend yourself, to defend your family, to defend your country when it's being invaded, but it's more problematic when the corruption and the invasion is from within. That's when things get a little hairy. So the military has been completely subverted. And the military, although it has the outward trappings of being almighty and all-powerful, there is some deep-seated pathologies that are at play and have been at play. I direct the listener to the book written by a former Army intelligence officer, Richard Gabriel, who viewers of the History Channel may know Richard Gabriel as a historian. He's written a number of histories, written some historical novels. I've read a bunch of his histories and historical novels. I like him. He's a very good writer. But the best book he ever wrote was called, take note of this book, please. It's called Military Incompetence, Why the U.S. Military Doesn't Win. And he goes into detail about why the U.S. military is so messed up, because at the higher ranks, they're run by a bunch of career bureaucrats. They're not war fighters. These are people that cannot plan operations. What the late Colonel David Hackworth would have called the perfume prince. I mean, let's look at some of the recent fiascos. Now, if you get that book, Richard Gabriel's book, A Military Incompetence, Why the American Military Doesn't Win, he goes into detail about five or six different military operations the U.S. undertook in the past and why every single one of them wound up being a fiasco. Operation Eagle Claw, the Iranian hostage rescue, which culminated in a disaster at Desert One, this refueling station. If they'd used the right kind of helicopters and the right kinds of pilots, Air Force pilots in particular that had experience in long-range, nap-of-the-earth flight with advanced instrumentation, night vision goggles, etc., they wouldn't have had to stop at Desert One. Instead, once again, they violate unity of command. It was a multi-tiered joint command operation because, as usual, where the U.S. military is concerned, everybody has to get into the act. Everyone has to have a share in the glory. So the U.S. Navy was involved. The helicopter stage off of the USS Nimitz. The Air Force flew the C-130 transport planes. The Army Rangers were involved. They were supposed to secure Desert One. Delta Force was supposed to go in and rescue the hostages, the American hostages in Iran. And, of course, the Marines had to get involved. And so what happened? They were put into the most critical part of the whole operation. They became the pilots of the helicopters. And that was a big mistake. Read his book to find out all the sort of details. And then you have Grenada. Grenada was the coming out party for the Joint Special Operations Command. Operation Urgent Fury. Oh, we've got to go rescue Grenada because it's been taken over by the communists and there's these American university students there, American students at a medical college. We have to rescue them, right? Actually, they put the American medical students in danger by invading the island. Joint Special Operations Command, as the name suggests, is a joint integrated command, Army, Navy, Air Force elements. The so-called SEAL Team 6 was the Navy SEAL component of Joint Special Operations Command. The Army elements were the Delta Force and elements of the U.S. Rangers. And the Grenada operation, Operation Urgent Fury in 1984, another cowboy operation by Ronald Reagan, was the coming out party for JSOC. And they planned a number of special operations. And if one or even all of them were successful, it wouldn't have made a difference as far as the invasion was concerned. And I happened to be watching Nightline after this fiasco. Richard Gabriel, the aforementioned Richard Gabriel, was on Nightline and he was talking about the Grenada operation. A number of U.S. Special Operations Forces were killed, members of JSOC, Navy SEALs, Delta operators. And Richard Gabriel said something that was quite powerful. He said, "Everyone from the British SAS down criticized this operation." That's a powerful statement. Because if you look at what the SAS has done, and again, I don't believe in war. Now, sometimes the SAS did go and do things that were helpful, like when they were in Oman in the late 60s, early 70s, culminating in the Battle of Murbat, where there was 9 SAS members against hundreds of Marxist communist rebels that were trying to take over this town called Murbat. 9 SAS soldiers, along with airstrikes from contract pilots and also former RAF and British pilots that were assigned to the Sultan of Oman's Air Force, provided much needed air cover for the beleaguered garrison of just 9 SAS troopers. And they killed hundreds of these Marxist communist rebels. After the battle, two SAS troopers walked the battlefield, and they noted they were writing down the serial numbers of the mortar rounds that did not explode, and they also found a Carl Gustav 84mm anti-armor shell embedded in a wall, and they were looking at the serial numbers of all this unexploded ordnance. The reason that the ordnance didn't explode is because the rebels didn't take care of their ordnance too well, plus it rained a lot the night before the battle, so the ground was very soft and the shells didn't go off. So what was interesting was these two SAS troopers went around checking the writing down all the serial numbers for all this unexploded ordnance, and they determined right off the bat, these are British mortar shells. These mortar bombs are British. This Carl Gustav 84mm round embedded in this wall is from British stocks. The British stocks had come from nearby Aden. The British had operated in Aden for many years. Somehow, after the British wound down their operations in Aden, a lot of this ordnance winds up in the hands of these communist Marxist rebels in nearby Oman. Now, the SAS troopers would notice something like that, right? And that's another thing. I've said this before, so some of you hearing me repeat myself, but the one thing I like about some of the Europeans that write their stories, particularly British soldiers, when they write about their experiences, they talk about their misgivings, their frustrations, their suspicions, right? It's not all flag waving. You get like endless amounts of flag waving, fighting terrorism, fighting Al-Qaeda, 9/11, yada, yada, yada. That's what you get out of typical American authors, American veterans who've served in Afghanistan, served in Iraq, and even in Vietnam. The authors, ex-military types who served in Vietnam. Oh, if the politicians would just let us win, they could have won in Vietnam. Well, that's the whole point. They weren't supposed to win in Vietnam, just like they're not supposed to win in Afghanistan, Syria. Well, they're trying to win in Syria, but they're not winning. And Yemen, most recently. Okay, but the point of relevance to this is the SAS, for many years, they had the ability to go into all these different countries, Malaya, Oman, Aden, Borneo. They get the job done very quietly, very unobtrusively, and they leave. A classic example of surgical precision of the SAS was the 1981 coup in Ghana. The president of Ghana was off in England attending the wedding of Princess Charles and Diana. Meanwhile, this Marxist coup takes place. The president's wife and family are kidnapped by the rebels. The Ghana government appealed to the British government for help. Two SAS operatives, one was a major, another was a senior non-commissioned officer, and they were shortly joined by a third SAS operative who was in the region. And they worked with the Senegalese army. Senegal is a larger country than Ghana, and surrounds it on three sides pretty much. The British had been training the Senegalese army, and so these three SAS operatives led the Senegalese army and restored order in the country of Ghana. Just the three of them. And we've seen this again and again with the SAS. No fuss, no big splash, no disaster, no Mogadishu-type meltdown. You look at Grenada. I was talking about Grenada earlier. There was a number of special operations that were planned that were totally unnecessary. For example, this unit of SEAL Team 6 members had jettisoned themselves out of the back of a speeding helicopter. They were on board the boat. The weather was really bad. The waves were choppy. And the SEALs that were in the inflatable boat, they hit the water really hard, knocked out an impact, and they drowned. So much for that operation. Another operation that went awry was element of SEAL Team 6 was supposed to knock out a radio station on Grenada, so the radio station wouldn't send out an alert to the Grenada forces and the Cuban advisors on the island and alert them to the fact that U.S. military forces were on the island. Well, they could not knock out, the Navy SEALs could not knock out that radio station. They wound up getting trapped, surrounded, and to their indignity had to be rescued by the Marines. The supposed rescue of the medical students was a fiasco in a mix-up of the air transport system. Large numbers of U.S. Army Rangers were left behind in their bases in both the East Coast and also in the West Coast in Washington State. There was a mix-up that prevented large numbers of Rangers from being flown to Grenada, and the Ranger elements that did go to Grenada, they pulled off a farcical rescue of these medical students who didn't need rescuing. In fact, if anything, they endangered them. There were some Rangers soldiers and officers who had to be talked out of demanding a court-martial and an inquiry into the behavior of some of the helicopter pilots. Some of the helicopter pilots flew away with Rangers still hanging on, you know, to the outside of the helicopter because the pilots were so scared. The Delta Force operators had landed at Point Salinas Airport in Grenada the night before the invasion. They were quickly spotted by the defenders. So the night before the invasion, the alert had already gone out throughout the island that the Americans had arrived. There's no reason for Delta Force to be scouting an airfield. That's not what they're trained for. But it was another make-work job. It was another example of JSOC, these officers making up all these operations that were not necessary. So you have the SEALs exiting the back of a high-speed, fast-moving helicopter at low altitude over choppy waters, and the SEALs on board the inflatable boat, could have been a Gemini, could have been a Zodiac, I don't know what kind. They get knocked out upon impact and they drown. You have the SEALs who tried to knock out the transmitter on the island. They get surrounded. They need the help from the Marines, perish the thought. You have Delta Force landing at an airfield, because if the plan worked out, then the Rangers would have been air assaulted right onto the airfield. The air transports would have landed and the Rangers would have disembarked. Now, that was the plan anyway. It didn't work out that way. Delta was spotted by the defenders. Richard Gabriel went on to say it took like two battalions, I think, or maybe more, of U.S. 82nd Airborne to move against, you know, about 50 Cuban advisors and construction workers and militia. So even though they had overwhelming force, they still couldn't move rapidly against the defenders. You look at the fake Bin Laden raid, where, again, the long-suffering SEAL Team 6. Apparently, SEAL Team 6 was used in this Yemen raid. Anyway, the fake Bin Laden raid, one of these aircraft crashed again, and there was a number of casualties. You look at Panama. Once again, a misuse of the Navy SEALs. There's a saying that the SEALs have, hey, diddle, diddle, charge up the middle. That's not what trained special operatives should do. Their job shouldn't be head-on fanatical charges. That's not what they're being paid for. That's not why they plow so much money and resources into training these people. But that's what they asked them to do in Panama. For some reason, some officer thought that it would be a great idea to secure the hangar in which General Noriega's plane was. They were afraid that if Noriega got away, he'd get to his plane, fly out to safety. So they sent SEAL Team 4 from Norfolk, Virginia, in to basically rush across the tarmac and try to take over the hangar. Now, they were out there hiding amongst all the equipment, the trucks and what have you on the runway, and the Panamanian Defense Force said, look, we know you're out there. They didn't know they were SEALs. They just knew they were Americans. We know you're out there. But why don't you just give yourselves up or just go away, right? We don't want to have to fight you. But orders are orders. And the Navy SEALs wound up following their orders. They rushed the hangar, and four of them were killed, at least four of them. Now, you look at a parallel scenario. The 1980 Falklands War. The French made Mirages and the Super Antandars were flying out of Argentinian airfields and wreaking havoc on the British Naval Task Force in San Carlos Bay. They were firing the Exocet missiles. They were dropping bombs on a number of British ships. So the high command said to the commander of B Squadron, 22nd SAS, we want you to go onto these airfields, destroy all the airplanes, and kill all the pilots. The commander of B Squadron said, no, he got fired. In the event, they settled for a compromise. They snuck small teams of SAS, and according to some sources, also members of Special Boat Service were also snuck onto Argentina to do a similar thing, to spy on the airfields and to send messages back alerting the task force that these planes were on the way. Okay? So the point of relevance here is an SAS officer commanding an entire squadron said, no, we're not going to do this suicide mission. He stood up for his men. He got fired. Why don't the SEAL commanders do that? Why don't they stand up and say, no, that's a crazy operation. We're not going to do that. But the reason they don't is because these officers, after a certain point, when these Army officers and these Marine officers and these Air Force officers and these Navy officers, when they get within sniffing range of promotion to be to receive a star, whether it's to be a Rear Admiral in the Navy or to be a Brigadier General in the Air Force or the Army, when they get within sniffing range of getting their first star, they turn corporate. They do whatever it takes. They kiss as much booty as they can. They follow the orders of their higher-ups, even ill-conceived orders, and they go along, and they get their ticket punched, and it doesn't matter what happens to the troops in the ranks. And that's why you have the fiasco at Panama. If the intention was to destroy Noriega's plane, why not just have a couple of planes fly over, drop some JDAMs onto the hangar, blow it up? The British had developed a bomb that creates craters. Why not drop a crater-making bomb at one end of the hangar and then drop another one at the other end? Maybe have an AC-130 Spectre gunship pump a bunch of 105mm cannon rounds into the hangar. Just flatten the hangar. If the intention was to prevent Noriega from using the plane as a getaway plane, why not just flatten the hangar with the plane inside of it? But no, they've got to send their Navy SEALs after it. See, the problem is the Navy SEALs are regarded as a direct action force. So these people who have no operational experience or limited operational experience, they think, oh, what are the neat ways we can insert the SEALs? Well, by boat, by helo, by marine killer Osprey planes, who knows? There had to be more than one SEAL killed in this operation. There had to be more than one American fatality, because just the crew members on board the Osprey, how many people crew one of those Ospreys? And another one crashed, right? And the SEAL operators on the ground were ambushed. Apparently, they were ambushed big time. But we're told that only just one died, right? It's just more lies. So why don't more of these commanders stand up and say, no, we're not going to do that. Oh, this fake bin Laden raid. No, we're not going to do that. Doesn't happen. In the SAS, the squaddies, the troopers in the ranks, they basically have the final say in an operation. The NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, up to the squadron sergeant major, all the way up to the regimental sergeant major. They're the ones that really run the regiment, the SAS regiment. And if the squaddies, the troopers in the ranks say, no, that's not going to work, then it's not going to be done, right? And I just mentioned earlier about how three SAS guys thwarted a coup in Ghana leading the Senegalese army. That's just one example. Just in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks after the abortive and humiliating debacle at Desert One in Iran, when the U.S. tried to rescue the hostages in Iran under the Carter administration, just within 1 or 2 weeks of that, the British SAS rescued the hostages, ironically, in the Iranian embassy in London, Prince's Gate, a classic operation. And the subtext of that, which a lot of people don't even get into, is that the terrorists that took over the Iranian embassy were being funded by Saddam Hussein, who at the time was a U.S. intelligence asset, go figure. But the moral of the story was the SAS took down a multi-story building in about 20 minutes, rescued all the hostages, and that happened a mere 1 or 2 weeks after the U.S. debacle in Iran. So, you know, the Delta operators could have gotten the job done had they gotten to Iran, to Tehran, the capital. They could have done the job, but it just, the way everything is set up with all these different services having to get in on the app, it was a direct result of the fiasco at Desert One, the reliance on the Marine helicopter pilots who were not trained for long-range nap of the earth flying. The Army created Task Force 160, a unit of highly trained, highly secretive helicopter pilots who flew the Black Hawk helicopter, and their job was to infiltrate and exfiltrate Delta Force. The Army Delta Force no longer wanted to work with aviators who were not highly trained in special operations aviation. Later, Task Force 160 changed their name to the 1st Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and their nickname is the Night Stalkers. And the U.S. had pulled off these hostage rescues in the past. Think of Cabana Tuan, U.S. Army Rangers. They made a movie about it, The Great Raid. About 500 American POWs left over from when MacArthur basically abandoned his army in Bataan and Corregidor. And elsewhere in the Philippine Islands, PI, a lot of the survivors were herded in the Cabana Tuan camp, and they were rescued by the Army Rangers. And you look at the 11th Airborne jump to free the civilian detainees, the civilian inmates at San Tomas University and Bilibid Prison in the Philippines. They rescued thousands of civilian internees. Right? So it's been done. The U.S. has done it before, but something has happened to their military capability. So it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of technological goodies these operators have. If they're going to be just sent to their slaughter, and then all these civilians get killed in the process, then it doesn't really matter. So we talked about the Yemen raid that just, and we're going to hear more and more about, you know, the real number of casualties sooner or later. And we talked about the fake bin Laden raid, Panama, hey, diddle, diddle, charge up the middle. If you want to stop Noriega from escaping in that plane, just blow up the whole hangar. You're blowing up the rest of Panama anyway, killing all these Panamanian civilians in the process. Might as well wipe out that hangar. Operation Eagle Claw, the abortive rescue of the Americans held in Iran. You have the Sante operation, Operation Ivory Coast. There was 70-some-odd American POWs kept in a POW camp 23 miles outside of Hanoi. So they sent in a team of special forces trained and led by Colonel Arthur Simmons, known as Bull Simmons, U.S. Army Ranger in World War II, a living legend. And they get the Sante, and there are no prisoners there. And basically, intelligence had already known there were no prisoners there. They'd been moved. They sent drones over the area and over the camp, and they sent SR-71 spy planes over. And there was no activity at the base, no activity at the POW camp. There was nobody home except probably some leftover North Vietnamese guards. But they sent in the rescue force anyway. And afterwards, of course, even though no one was there to be rescued, they gave out all the awards and they gave Arthur Simmons a Distinguished Service Cross. And so the moral of the story is, it's they keep sending these highly trained people, trained at, you know, the public's expense, and they just send them to their doom. And the people they're supposed to be fighting against, the people they're supposed to be killing or capturing, and they're always told, folks, that this is a tier one target. You're going after a tier one target, right? Some guy with an Arabic-sounding name, right? And meanwhile, the real tangos, the real terrorists, are being armed and financed and, you know, trained by mercenaries and trained by black ops, special operations people. Sooner or later, I don't know, maybe never. It may never dawn on these military people, especially the Americans, how they're being played. So, you know, keep all this in mind, because Trump is authorized, I'm sure at the behest of his masters, to send in more special operations forces to try to create chaos and disruption within Iran, right? So Iran is a whole different kettle of fish, folks. Iran has short-range, medium-range, and long-range missiles. They can hammer a number of U.S. bases throughout the whole region. And Iran survived a long war against Iraq. You know, these people, they're not just going to roll over and go the way of, you know, Libya and all these other places. No, they're going to fight. So, you know, and again, who is the one that apparently had the final say-so in this latest abortive raid in Yemen? It was Trump's son-in-law, a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, former member of the IDF, right? So, no, the honeymoon is over, folks. It's, you know, the whole thing was a psyop. This whole thing with Trump, and he's going to be the savior, he's going to be the messiah. It's time to really wake up and smell the coffee. Yeah, the honeymoon is over as far as Donald Trump is concerned. Oh, one last thing before we end the segment about U.S. Special Operations fiascos. Another fiasco, melodrama, was the fake rescue of Jessica Lynch. Jessica Lynch was being helped by Iraqi doctors. She'd suffered an injury. She was part of a supply transport unit that had gotten bushwhacked, and she'd been getting medical treatment from Iraqi doctors. She was in no danger whatsoever. Next thing you know, here comes Delta Force in a highly publicized rescue operation to take her away to safety. It was just more of the movie, folks. And the thing about it is, it's a movie for us. These fake raids, these like the fake Jessica Lynch rescue, is very real when the bullets start flying for the operators on the ground, for the civilians on the ground who happen to be there, who happen to live there for, you know, their families for countless millennia, because that's where they're from, and they get invaded, and then they get branded as insurgents, right? So we've reached the end of this segment of Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. And if you like what we do, you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member. And wherever you may be, dear listeners, have a very pleasant time. Thank you.